Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. We take a look at tomorrow's feast of Palm Sunday and the Passion of our Lord and find out more about its significance, its history, and how this commemoration is marked in different ways around the world. Palm Sunday is also the Church's World Youth Day, marked at a diocesan level, and we speak to a young person whose participation in this event transformed her life. The first Catholic church to be built in the Gulf state of Qatar was consecrated today, and the Apostolic Vicar of Arabia tells us more. And here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict has received Greece's new ambassador to the Holy See and spoke about the strengthening bonds of goodwill between the two states. Tomorrow, March the 16th, is Palm Sunday and the Passion of our Lord. The Feast of Palm Sunday commemorates the last entry of Jesus into Jerusalem before his crucifixion, and it takes its name from the custom of blessing palms and of carrying portions of branches in procession. The practice recalls the biblical account of how people strewed palms in the path of Jesus as a sign of reverence as he rode into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. But when did this custom first begin? What is its spiritual meaning? And how is Palm Sunday celebrated in different countries of the world? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Father Keith Peklers, an expert on the liturgy, at the Pontifical Gregorian University.
Well, of course, it inaugurates, it opens the celebration of Holy Week, the holiest of weeks in the Christian year. And it is quite an ancient feast, actually. It goes back to the 4th century in terms of the documentation we have on the origins of Palm Sunday.
And when the custom first began of celebrating Palm Sunday, it didn't necessarily start then, did it, the practice of blessing palms and carrying branches? Did that come later on?
That's right. We have the first documentation we have actually comes from a Spanish pilgrim, Egeria, at the end of the 4th century, who spoke about the gathering at the Mount of Olives, the Christians in Jerusalem, who would, in the late afternoon, meet at the Mount of Olives to read from the scriptures. And after that, they would process with palms into the city itself to continue their own worship and their own prayer. But what we know today as a formal ritual of blessing palms and that sort of thing, that comes actually later on in the 8th century.
And did it originate in Rome, as far as we know?
Well, actually, we have testimony in several places, in Spain, modern-day Spain, and in France, and also in Jerusalem itself. As always, the practice is somewhat varied because we have cultural differences that are present. For example, palm was not readily available in certain places, and therefore where palm branches were not available.
What other wood was mostly used in its place?
Well, for instance, in Germany, there were willow branches that were used. But basically, any form of green branch that would be available in a particular country was considered to be acceptable, to be useful for the actual procession with the branches.
I gather that some countries also called it Flower Sunday because there was this custom of blessing flowers and entwining them amongst the palms. Is that still practiced?
That's right. Well, as always, this is something that we find kind of the cultural differences that exist from place to place. In the Philippines, for example, not just Palm Sunday, but all of Holy Week is quite elaborately celebrated, and much would depend on what is available in the particular country. But there's also a dimension, kind of a magical dimension, to these branches that was common in the Middle Ages, where there was a certain association between, there was a belief that these particular branches had certain spiritual powers in themselves, which is actually how the tradition began of people bringing the branches home to keep during the year, oftentimes placed behind a crucifix.
I mean, in fact, palm branches have been used by all nations, haven't they, as an emblem of joy and victory
That's
over
right.
enemies.
That's right. The origins of the palm branches focus very much on joy, on life, on victory, victory over death. But gradually, what happens is that these palm branches come to be associated with healing and with spiritual powers, and that spreads then through the Middle Ages and into the subsequent centuries.
And I gather also that the blessed palms are used to procure the ashes that are used on Ash Wednesday.
That's right. So again, there's a whole link. We speak of the liturgical year as cyclical, that you know, we begin, first Sunday of Advent, we speak of this whole journey, this movement, eschatologically speaking, moving towards the reign of God, the whole liturgical year essentially as a walking through our own salvation history. And we see that very clearly in the burning of palm branches the following year for the making of ashes to inaugurate the new season of Lent.
And sometimes the palms themselves are actually twisted into different shapes, aren't they? What kind of shapes?
Well, oftentimes we've seen you see it in many homes, people will make a cross. They'll use their palm branches to actually make a form of a cross and place that in the home. But that tradition, actually, of using palm branches and bringing them home and forming them into different shapes, that goes back to the middle of the 8th century and then expands from there.
And I read somewhere that in some countries or regions, the blessed palms are even used to decorate graves.
That's right. Basically, this is it's an object that's associated so deeply with the Christian spirituality, with the symbolism of the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's a symbol that people hold very dearly because even those perhaps who... It's a time when people come back to church as well because they feel this connection even through the symbol of the palm branches. And we'll use them to decorate graves, to be revered in the home and in the coming year. And it becomes a reminder, at least ideally, a reminder of the call of the Christian to be with Christ throughout the year.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, there are cultural differences in how Palm Sunday is celebrated in countries throughout the world. Can you describe for our listeners one or two of the most colourful ceremonies for Palm Sunday that you've either come across, either in person or read about?
Well, I've seen, certainly in Jerusalem itself, I've been present there several occasions, the beginning of Holy Week. And there, of course, it's quite dramatic. It's dramatic, first of all, because of the whole tradition, the history of what we hold in common as Christians. And the walking through the streets of the old city with very large palm branches led by the patriarch with his assistants, but all the people following. So it's quite dramatic to be processing through the streets there in Jerusalem. But there are also very colorful processions in southern Spain, for example, part of the link to the confraternities in places like Granada and Seville, where, again, the streets are blocked off and the procession is not simply from one church to another in a very minimal way, but it's basically the whole city becomes a sacred space. And in fact, the streets are lined with palms as you proceed through, as the procession moves through the streets of the old town, whether it be in Granada or in Seville. And then, as well, there would be the Philippines, where you find not just the famous Good Friday processions and the Passion, the actual crucifixion, the flagellation,
yes.
But Holy Week itself is inaugurated with in many towns and cities throughout the Philippines, very dramatically through the city being lined with palm branches and being carried in procession.
As a liturgist, can you now briefly run through the rituals of Palm Sunday? Let's begin, first of all, with the benediction of the palms.
Right. We really find it's the 8th century. It's the Missal of Bobbio in northern Italy that gives us the first information, really, the first liturgical information on this blessing of the palms. As always, the liturgical life of the church evolves gradually, and so too on Palm Sunday. It doesn't all happen at once. But we find first mention of Palm Sunday in the 4th century. Then at the beginning of the 7th century, we find mention of the importance of the blessing of palms. And then by the middle of the 8th century, this is much more elaborate and includes also a procession from one station to another station, from one church to another church. So since the middle of the 8th century, the Missal of Bobbio, we find reference to the blessing of palms and this gospel that is read of the palms, which essentially begins the solemn procession, the solemn initiation, the inauguration of Holy Week from one church to the designated church for the principal celebration of the Mass. And that remains the case today in the current Missal of Pope Paul VI. We actually, in many parishes, it's not possible to essentially to enact this in a very grand way because parishes are limited in the space that's available and that sort of thing. But ideally speaking, there is the first station where there is the greeting, the introduction, the reading of the Gospel of the Palms, the blessing of the palms, and then the celebrant of the Mass then says, let us proceed, and the procession then moves from that first station to the actual place where Mass is going to be celebrated. But as I mentioned, in many parishes, it's not possible to do such a grand procession, and therefore it's maybe more limited just outside the church doors, moving into the church. But the idea, of course, is that each person holds their palm branches aloft as those branches are blessed, carry the branches then in procession to the place where Mass will be celebrated. And these branches are waved and carried as a sign of love and respect and devotion to Christ. It's essentially a way of bearing testimony to Christ, particularly if one is walking through the streets of a city like Rome or any city in procession with the clergy and the ministers vested in liturgical attire. It's quite a strong statement of belief and of testimony in the midst of secular society to actually carry those branches aloft and sing the classic hymn, All Glory, Lord and Honor, which actually dates back to the middle of the 8th century.
Coming to the Mass itself and the singing of the Passion, can you tell us something more about that?
Yes, again, very early on, certainly in the 8th century, there's a clear link between the celebration of Palm Sunday and what will happen on Good Friday in terms of the liturgical prayers, the liturgical, the texts, the readings.
So this linking has been there, right? Almost.
It's quite old. It's been there certainly since the medieval period, middle of the 8th century. And the idea is always, it's not to recreate or to reenact historically what happened, but the idea is rather to bear testimony in our own day to this fact. We do find, though, very much in the Middle Ages and beyond, that what catches on very quickly is a desire to incorporate drama into the Palm Sunday celebration and, in fact, into, you think of the mystery plays, but into Holy Week itself. So to try to reenact dramatically some of these processions entering into Jerusalem, for example, whether it be with children or with adults. And that kind of thing is very present in terms of popular religion, even in our own day, depending on the country one is in.
In which countries is it most?
Well, for example, in Latin America, you find this quite commonly present in different Latin American countries, where, and not only in Latin America, some Asian countries as well, where the children are included very much in the procession, and they may be dressed in certain costumes, for example, that would resemble, ideally, figures from the gospel who are recorded, who are mentioned regarding this feast of this occasion, Palm Sunday. The idea is really to bear witness and to put into practice what we hold and what we believe about the faith, and particularly about the passion, the suffering of Christ. The readings are very significant because the readings on Palm Sunday, the Philippians reading, speaks about Christ's obedience even unto death, death on the cross. So already from the very beginning, we have that link. The fact that we read the Passion not only on Good Friday but also on Palm Sunday is yet another example of the importance of this link. Palm Sunday is very much setting the stage for what will unfold during the Paschal Triduum, and that we very much see this as one piece. Significant that, you know, Palm Sunday, when you look at the Roman Missal, our own Missal today, it's called Palm Sunday of the Passion of Christ. So in some context, it's referred to as Passion Sunday, Palm Sunday.
Often both.
But the idea is that it's both and. It's both Palm Sunday, commonly called, but perhaps even more importantly, Passion Sunday.
That was Father Keith Peklers of the Pontifical Gregorian University. Oh, no, oh. Palm Sunday is also the Catholic Church's World Youth Day, celebrated at a diocesan level, and thousands of young people are converging on central Rome to be with Pope Benedict in St. Peter's Square for the blessing of the palms and olives, the procession with the branches, and the Mass to celebrate the Passion of our Lord. Quite a number of those young people will have visited the San Lorenzo International Youth Centre close to St. Peter's Square, which celebrated the 25th anniversary of its inauguration this week with a visit by Pope Benedict, who celebrated Mass there. The San Lorenzo Centre was set up in 1983 with the encouragement of Pope John Paul, who wanted a place of welcome and prayer for young people from all over the world who come to Rome on pilgrimage. The San Lorenzo Centre also houses the first World Youth Day cross, donated to the centre by the late Pope in 1984. Lyndon Blauvin is the young head of the San Lorenzo Centre, and her own participation in the World Youth Day celebration in Rome in 2000 marked a turning point in her life as a Christian. She began by telling me that many groups of young people are coming to the Vatican for the Palm Sunday liturgical celebration this year.
There's people coming especially for that celebration. It's more or less the Diocese of Rome, the young people from the Diocese of Rome that will come to this celebration on St. Peter's Square. So we have a lot of groups that are coming.
But do you get people coming from overseas, though, nonetheless?
I think there's always people coming for the Holy Week and for Palm Sunday, and so they will have this celebration to prepare the World Youth Day, yes.
When you talk to the young people, whether they're from Rome or from overseas, what do they give as their reasons for wanting to celebrate World Youth Day? How important do they see this celebration?
I think there's a new generation that got up into the church, that is the World Youth Day generation. I think for many young people, it's been a turning point, a conversion point in their lives. I think in many young people's lives, it's been a really important appointment, and so they want to continue also this journey. Even for me, it's a really big appointment, because it was for me a turning point for my own life. So I encourage other people to go, because I think it could be a good experience for them also.
And have you been to many of the World Youth Days that's been celebrated around the world?
I have been to the World Youth Days in Rome in the year 2000, and to World Youth Days in Cologne in 2005. And actually, World Youth Days in Rome has been for me a turning point in my life with the Lord, because...
When you say a turning point, do you mean that you were, in a sense, perhaps not so close to the church and were brought closer to the church, or that your faith was somehow deepened? What do you mean?
Well, I had a faith in the Lord, but I was a little bit far from the church. And the experience of going to Tor Vergata when we were all together, to see all these young people together in this celebration of the faith, it was for me a new experience. So that was one thing, and then the next thing was the meeting with the Holy Father and the words that he said, the encouragement that he gave and so on. The image that we have through the media is a little bit of a turn image. And so at that point, I realized that what the Holy Father said was a message of hope, which is not a message that we hear a lot as young people. He encouraged us really to be missionaries, to be the apostles of the new millennium. It was a message that really changed my life also. So after that, I really started getting into church teaching and so on. I couldn't go to Toronto in 2002, but I went to Cologne in 2005 as organizing the Diocese of Belgium. I was the one that encouraged the other ones to go. So that's a little bit my story, but I know there's many others that have the same story as a turning point, World Youth Day.
I was talking there to Lyndon Blauvin from Rome's San Lorenzo International Youth Centre. Today saw the consecration of the first ever Catholic church in the Gulf state of Qatar. Located on the outskirts of the capital Doha, the Church of Our Lady of the Rosary is Qatar's first purpose-built Christian church, although several other Christian denominations are also planning or have already started to build churches in the same compound. They include the Greek Orthodox Church, the Anglicans, and the Copts.
the Catholic Church will cater to the pastoral needs of the tens of thousands of Catholic migrants who come to Qatar for work. Most are Indians, Filipinos, Lebanese and Western nationals who up until now have not had a purpose-built church in Qatar in which to celebrate Mass. The building of the first Christian church in a Muslim state like Qatar sparked a heated debate between Muslims in the local media. One critic even branded the concept as repulsive, but supporters said building places of worship for other religions is a right guaranteed by Islam. Saturday's inauguration of the Catholic Church was presided over by Cardinal Ivan Dias, head of the Congregation for the Evangelization of Peoples, and by Bishop Paul Hinder, Apostolic Vicar of Arabia, whose diocese encompasses six nations in the Gulf region. Earlier, I spoke to Bishop Hinder and began by asking him to describe the significance of this church that has risen within the heart of the Gulf region.
I think, first of all, it's significant for our people in Qatar, because until now there was only a provisorium and most of the liturgies were in different places, in school halls or in a provisorium of the parish center we had already. So to get a church and other premises around, we will have finally a home for all the Catholics which are attending the celebrations as well as the formation and dedication work in faith. And I think it's very important for our people to have a place where they can go, where people can meet, and they know there I will find my brothers and sisters. And that is for the people in Qatar an extraordinary thing.
How much did the church cost, and is it true that the faithful helped to pay for it?
No, the cost approximately, because we have not yet reached the end, but the final cost will be around 75 million Qatari riyals. That makes around 20 million US dollars. The money is mainly from our own faithful in the whole vicariate. It's a work of the solidarity of all the faithful in the vicariate from the Sunday collections. Of course, we didn't make it in 1 year. That was since many years we planned this construction and had to spare the money for this building.
And roughly speaking, how many people do you anticipate are likely to come to Mass each Sunday?
Yeah, of course, it's difficult to know, because until now we were spread in different places and it was difficult to have exact figures. I think that finally, when we have this center and also transport is well organized, that for their weekend, I am speaking about Friday, which is the main day, and then Sunday to Saturday, that we will have around probably 20,000 or even more people.
How would you describe in general the Catholic community in Qatar? Of course, it's not really an open church, at least up to now, but you are on record as saying it's a church that's full of vitality with a good turnout at Mass. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I would say it's a very vital church in a general way, especially regarding the participation in the liturgy, in the whole devotional aspect of our life, also the mutual help among the faithful and so on. Of course, we have no other structures. We have no schools, we have no hospitals and so on, at least for the moment, not the case in Qatar. So the whole parish life is concentrated around the parish center now. But for that, the commitment of the people is extraordinary, and I think also their prayer and faith life is very deep.
Now, as you well know, the building of this first Catholic church in Qatar did spark a heated debate between some Muslims that was aired in the local press. I mean, one critic described it,
yes,
that the church as repulsive, although I gather supporters said that building places of worship for other religions is a right guaranteed by Islam. So were there a lot of difficulties for you because of this opposition? How did you react to it?
Well, me personally, I didn't react at all because I was not directly questioned. I let the debate go on. By the way, when it was on its top, I was not in the country. I was in the other side of the vicariate. But I think it was inescapable that one debate would one day be, because a country which was closed in a similar way like Saudi Arabia until, let's say, 15 years ago, we shouldn't be surprised that there are reactions, because within the Muslim world itself, there are obviously different tendencies, and that some express their feelings, also their perplexity regarding this openness to the church, I can understand. Would have difficulties if it were a reaction with violence, but that it was questioned, I am not surprised. But on the whole, I didn't get the impression that the people of Qatar as a people would react in a negative way.
And is it because of these sensitivities that this Catholic Church in Qatar doesn't have a cross on the outside of the building?
Yeah, that is obviously true, because normally it's part of the contract you have to sign. There is said that the architectural conditions and specifications and the terms of the building license have to be respected. Then undertaken not to place any religious signs on the church facades. Of course, in the interior of the church, everything we need for church, also statues, pictures and religious symbols and so on, that's not a difficulty. But that's a general rule here in different countries, that from outside, from the road, no explicit Christian sign should be seen.
I was speaking there to Bishop Paul Hinder, Apostolic Vicar of Arabia. Finally, here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict received today Greece's new ambassador to the Holy See, Miltiades Hiskakis, who presented his letters of credence. In his address to the ambassador, the Holy Father spoke about the strengthening bonds of goodwill between the two states. Chris Altieri reports.
In remarks delivered to the ambassador, Pope Benedict said several significant encounters have strengthened the bonds of goodwill between Greece and the Holy See recently, including the visit John Paul II made to Greece during his pilgrimage in the footsteps of St. Paul in the wake of the Jubilee year of 2000. Pope Benedict also recalled the 2006 visit to the Vatican of Greece's president and the visit from His Beatitude Christodoulos, who died this year. Pope Benedict said Christians in Greece and throughout the world continue to mourn Christodoulos' passing and prayed the Lord will grant this devoted pastor rest from his labors and bless him for his valiant efforts to mend the breach between Christians in the East and West. Pope Benedict also extended sincere fraternal greetings of peace to the new Archbishop of Athens and all Greece, His Beatitude Hieronymus. The Pope expressed his hope that the imminent Pauline year will become a catalyst that will spark reflection upon the history of Europe and stir its inhabitants to rediscover the inestimable treasure of values they have inherited from the integral wisdom of Hellenistic culture and the Gospel. Pope Benedict also discussed the developing relationship between the Catholic Church and civil authorities in Greece and thanked the ambassador for the assurance of his government's resolve to address administrative issues concerning the Catholic Church in the country. The Holy Father said when religious leaders and civil authorities work together to formulate fair legislation in regard to the life of local ecclesial communities, the spiritual welfare of the faithful and the good of all society are enhanced. The Holy Father concluded, recalling the devastation caused by the wildfires that raged through Greece last summer, and said in his prayers he continues to remember those who were affected by the disaster and asked God abundantly to bless the beloved people of Greece. I'm Chris Altieri.
And that's all from the English program for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.